Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book club.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back.
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for season 3, episode 20, The Man Behind the Curtain. And I have a question for you guys. What's a better island birthday gift for a friend than a creepy wooden doll of yourself? My name is Dave Gonzalez, and if you've been listening to the podcast, you know that I have made a treehouse hotel with a monkey-operated elevator, so you get a free night there, and good news, the monkeys make minimum wage now.
What's minimum wage on the island?
Three cabins.
Oh, I was gonna say five mangoes. Three cabins is way better. All right, my name is Joanna Robinson, and if I were to give an island birthday gift to a friend, it would be a gun to kill my problematic father with? ? Thanks, Alex, for the inspo.
And I'm Neil Miller, and my island birthday gift to just about anybody I could find would be a gas mask, because you always want to be prepared, I guess, for the worst.
It's a good birthday gift this week and really all weeks. Just like, why not have a gas mask around? Is something I've learned in life. You're listening to the Storm Lost Rewatch Podcast. We are a podcast that is rewatching the ABC series Lost. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. It's an ideal companion if you're rewatching Lost or visiting the island for the first time. Each podcast episode comes in two sections: a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers, and that being the spoilers, is for a section called The Storm. It's the storm of spoilers, discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series of Lost and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcast device, you will see some time codes that, if you're very lucky, will appear as little links. That means you could skip to those things and control your spoilage. Or you could just, you know, strap in and stay on this roller coaster. It has its ups and downs, but it keeps its own momentum. If you want to support us besides just listening to the podcast, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There we have offers where you could subscribe and kick us a little money monthly, and in return, we will give you some delicious bonus content. It takes the form of access to our exclusive Slack. You get to do live watches with us. You get bonus podcasts. You get to ask us questions in a mailbag. Of those bonus podcasts, there's not only bonus podcasts with Neil, Joanna, and I, but Joanna has been doing two extra bonus podcasts for our Patreons at patreon.com/stormofspoilers. Joanna, I hear that you've been gallivanting through time with one of America's most huggable muscly men.
Oh, yeah, I did. Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Dave Chen.
Dave Chen and I hugged Jean-Claude Van Damme together. Yeah, the series we're calling either Gen Pop or Chen Pop, depending if you're Neil Miller or not, is just like a series of random, if I watch something or Dave watches something, we want to talk about it, we're going to talk about it. For instance, I put a poll up on Twitter this week with four animated film blind spots and asked people which is the most urgent for me to watch. And everyone wants me to watch Prince of Egypt, which I've never seen. Like vast majority. And so then Dave Chen texts me, he's like, hey. want to do a podcast about Prince of Egypt? So I'm gonna watch Prince of Egypt this weekend, then we're gonna talk about it, and then if you're a $10 subscriber to our Patreon, you get to listen to that. How lucky are you? Also, Kristen and I have been scheming our October plans for Feels Like the First Time, the podcast where, you know, we show each other something that the other hasn't seen. And we're thinking of doing like a spooky movie trade-off. She definitely wants me to watch A Nightmare on Elm Street. It's not the first one. I don't know which one it was. Maybe Dream Warriors. I can't really remember, but...
Wait. Kristen wants you to watch A Nightmare on Elm Street?
Yeah.
It's the second one, the gay one.
Oh, okay. It's the second one, the gay one. And I have to figure out some sort of spooky movie that Kristen hasn't seen, because that's a tall order, because she's actually a spook aficionado. So, that's what we got planned, in addition to all of our, like, storm chasing and mailbag episodes that we do for our Patreons. So, Patreon subscribers. So if you go to patreon.com/stormspoilers, you can sign up there, hang out with us in our Slack, all that sort of stuff. That's not the only way to be in touch with us. Of course, you can also go to our website, stormpodcast.com. Like, for example, this week, the podcast is a day late. That's my fault. I had to go to the vet on an emergency trip. And if you subscribe, you know, if you look at our webpage, the calendar reflects that. So you guys are sitting around on Wednesday being like, hey, where's my Storm Podcast? You can find it at stormpodcast.com. You can also tweet us at Storm Podcast. That's where we run our weekly Kistery poll. You can also leave us a review. We love reviews. This one, I'm going to read one real quick that comes from Bonesaw. It was like really hard for me not to say Sawyer in the context of reading that word. So Bonesaw. 5 stars. The title of the review is The Real Antagonists. Love the pod. I knew about your work and dabbled during Game of Thrones, but I recently started a rewatch with my wife, who never finished the series. The Storm has been an amazing companion on our journey. I have many thoughts about my unified theory and the incredible way the show explores theology that I'll share in an email soon, but want to mention here that theorizing that Locke is the main antagonist is fine and dandy as long as we consider the other main candidate, Jack.
Hey.
In my opinion, Jack has not aged well, and his actions are just as questionable as Locke's in terms of harm caused by them and their questionable intent. At the very least, Locke doesn't assume in all cases that he is better than every other person he encounters on the island or off. Jack is the worst kind of elitist, which causes all kinds of problems for everyone. There's probably more to be said about Jack needing to create problems to fix. As far as the antagonist of the podcast, I'm tempted to say Dave because, well, it's Dave. However,
compelling argument.
Choosing Red Vines over Twizzlers is objectively evil, so Joanna is clearly the villain. Keep up the good content. Thanks. So, I'm the villain because I am from the West Coast and we eat Red Vines, not Twizzlers.
Yeah, yes. It's going to be great. It's flash forward to the future and I'm appointing a Supreme Court justice and you guys are like, Neil likes pineapple on pizza. Crucify him.
You can also always get in contact with us, contact with us over email, host@stormpodcast.com. We love your emails. I'm going to read a quick one from one of our Slack moderators, Shruti, who also is sort of the one who brainstormed our weekend live watches that we do in the Slack. So Shruti writes, love the show. And Shruti is like, I love all of our listeners, but I like watching Shruti's progress through the show because she is a first-time watcher and 0% afraid to, like, wildly speculate even if she's wrong. You know what I mean? Like, I can understand why a lot of the first-time watchers wouldn't want to do that in front of people who've already seen the show because you don't want to, like, seem silly in your guesses. But I love that Shruti's just like, I'm just going to share. And she's very good. She's good at figuring out what's going on. Anyway. Shruti says, love the show and having the opportunity to watch this show on a week-by-week basis with others who are watching for the first time. I feel like the coolest thing about week-to-week TV is having unique memories of where you were when you watched a specific episode of television. For example, vivid memories of where you were when you watched the Ozymandias episode of Breaking Bad or The Winds of Winter. If I binge-watched Lost, that would all be a blur, but I like that I remember the specific weekend I watched the Lost Season 1 finale. It was the weekend the Game of Thrones concert was in L.A., and I got to discuss the finale with other L.A. Slack folks that weekend. Thank you so much for all you do. I have a quick question. When y'all mentioned characters being killed off, Boone or Ana Lucia or Nikki and Paula, for example, because they weren't working, what does that mean? Is it that the writers didn't know what to do with them, or that general audiences didn't like them / they weren't testing well according to ABC's testing? When I interned at CBS, I got to see the pilot testing process, but I didn't realize shows went into testing even in later seasons. Very excited to continue watching the show and see how the mysteries unfold. I love theorizing about everything. I have a bunch of wild theories that are probably not true, but it's just fun to talk theories with other commies. One of my wacky theories, Jai Lee and Sun were meant to be together. Our smooth boy never went dark and started yelling at Sun to cover himself up. He was her first choice until she bumped into Jin, and she was still rekindled that romance once Jin went dark. This theory also means Daniel Dae Kim was meant for someone other than Sun. Is that person me? Maybe. I also know that time works wacky on this show, but I haven't formulated that into a particular theory. It feels like they could have used that phenomenon to keep Walt around, but maybe not. Sorry for sending such a long email. I meant to keep it just my quick question, but ended up rambling. Thanks again. So that's Shruti. So yeah, so what
there are so many good ideas in that email that I wish this podcast could be about that email.
So what do you guys feel like you're saying when you say a character just wasn't working? Start with Neil.
Well, I think, you know, Lost gives us so many examples. And I think they all have their own unique. I think, you know, sometimes it's the actor maybe doesn't fit with the rest of the cast, or maybe the chemistry doesn't work between them and, you know, other characters in their storyline. I think a lot of it's probably, yeah, that the writers just, they either hit a wall or they can't quite figure out exactly how to get this character where they want them to. And I think shooting in Hawaii was a thing. I mean, I think we've brought it up a bunch of times that, like, you know, casting bad accents, for instance, is sort of a result of being in Hawaii and having sort of a limited pool. But then when you want, like, a big actor, you have to convince them to come live in Hawaii for 6-7 months out of the year. And, you know, not everybody wanted to come back. So I think there's, like, a buffet of reasons why it doesn't work. I don't know how much it actually has to do with testing. Dave may actually know a little bit more about that than I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that things do have a reaction of testing while the season is still being shot. I don't think that would necessarily be what we know, what we've learned about Lost through, like, the official podcast and Joanna talking to Damon and whatnot. It seems like Lost had the benefit at this point of being super popular, so the network wanted the show to keep going on, but they kind of left it to the writers to figure out characters. So I think Neil's depiction is accurate that when we're talking about this person didn't work on Lost, it was just sort of like they thought there was a story there.
Right.
And the more they plugged into it, the more they realized that story was either shorter than they thought or just plain not as interesting as they thought. I don't think there's a case that we know about currently where the network was like, people don't like this, we need to switch it out. There have been a couple episodes where they switched the subject of the flashback. I believe Joanna's talked about the one, the Sawyer Tallahassee job, which was sort of a quality pull, but it was a quality Tampa job. It was a quality pull from the show itself. It wasn't, from what I understand, like a networks or a testing pull. And I think that, not to get too far ahead of this week's podcast, but the week this aired originally was also the week that Lost announced its end date. Mm-hmm. So from here on out in this episode, I'd be surprised if we pick more than two or three characters that don't end up, you know, quote unquote, working for us. And that's because now they have an ending to the narrative. So now they actually know what the puzzle they're building on the front of the box is. In seasons 1-3, a lot of it was just trying to find new stories and mature the show within the framework of what they thought the show was. And I think that's where you get things like the Taileys sort of all dying off, except Bernard, who then doesn't appear for most of the season. That's like the best case scenario for a character where they know they have more to do with him, but they just want to hold for it. I think other things like Nikki and Paolo, we know they wanted to do like a longer series of episodes, like maybe a whole episode that was expose, the show within the show, and then, you know, revealed Billy Dee Williams as playing himself at like the end of the episode, which would have been weird, and they decided not to do it. But that's like a story-based choice.
That's such a Damon Lindelof thing to do. I know it wasn't his like idea, but anyway, it's like it would have been. Yeah, and I like I'm trying to recall like things that Damon has said that would imply that they got like feedback from the network. And like you're always getting feedback from the network if you're running a show. You know, and that's for example, that's what a lot of creators love about Netflix is that usually the note for there are like no notes from Netflix, so they're mm-hmm. like great. But your show
until
show's
the second season,
I was gonna say your show's gonna be canceled in two seasons, but until then, do whatever you want. But Damon has this stuff like, well, part of that is a function of Josh Holloway being so popular with audiences, but I don't think he needed. Like a network note to tell him that Damon is always, well, especially in the last days and with the podcast, stuff like that, so keyed in to what the audience reaction is of what he's doing that, like, I don't think he would need numbers to be able to tell you which characters were really hitting with his audience and what wasn't, you know? I think he probably mm-hmm. pays less attention to that now because he's been through therapy, but at the time, I think he was paying
well,
less
I think.
Attention. Yeah.
Now he has the benefit of, in his post-loss career, he never has to start anything that he doesn't know how he wants to finish it.
Yeah.
Whether or not it, you know, ends up finishing the way that he wants it to, I think that's sort of what he learned. Not that, you know, you need to have your final scene in a box and keep it secret and build to that over a decade, but at least he learned storytelling-wise in a mass audience to sort of tread more gently with promising answers and things. Except for Prometheus.
I did want to quickly show... Well, Prometheus wasn't his fault, right? Like, wasn't that... Like, wasn't there a lot of Ridley Scott interference? Anyway. I want to do like a quick sidebar about the Emmys. Like, you know, Damon won... first time 15 since season one of Lost, Damon Lindelof got an Emmy. That was great. But I want to shout out a snub, and I already like railed about this on my podcast about award season, but Stephen Williams, our guy, friend mm-hmm. of the pod, Stephen Williams, is my biggest number one snub of the Emmys night because he did not win for his excellent episode of Watchmen. But he was there looking like very handsome in the Watchmen group. But he justice for Stephen Williams is all I want.
Seriously.
I'm going to save our other emails for a future date because I feel like I've been probably rambling enough. But we got a lovely one from Caitlin that I will read in future that was just, like, really sweet. So thank you, Caitlin, for that. And I just want to mention before we roll on that this week in our Patreon Slack on Saturday, we're watching Greatest Hits. Our producer Diana is hosting that viewing. So Diana is really excited to hang out with you guys for a Charlie episode on Saturday. But it's a great episode. Great episode of Lost. So you'll have fun watching that. And then on October 3rd, my birthday, we are all of us hanging out in the Slack on that Saturday at 3 p.m. Pacific, right? That's mm-hmm. the time? Yep. To watch the season 3, the two-part season finale. So it's 2 hours, 3 o'clock Pacific, 6 o'clock Eastern. My birthday, October 3rd, we will all be there, or be square to watch what is some of the finest episodes of television ever, I think. So, really excited.
Yeah. And then we'll be season wise halfway through instead of just episode count wise halfway through.
And that's all I got to say. Hey, Neil.
Mm-hmm.
What happened on Lost?
Well, plenty of things happened this week on Lost. This episode, The Man Behind the Curtain, was directed by Bobby Roth. It was written by Elizabeth Sarnoff and Drew Goddard, and it aired on May 9th, 2007. That was 2 days after they announced the end date of Lost. This episode takes place on days 89 and 90 on the island. In flashbacks, we learn about how Ben was not exactly born on the island, but rather just outside of Portland. He did come to the island later, however, as part of the Dharma Initiative, and in his quest to escape a life with his bad dad, Roger Workman, Ben runs off into the woods after his ghost mom, only to find Richard, an ageless wonder. He convinces this man, Richard, who he's looking good with his long hair, convinces Ben to be patient because years later he'll get to murder his own father alongside the rest of the Dharma Initiative. Shambhala indeed. Back at the beach camp, Sawyer returns and calls a camp meeting to discuss Juliet's treachery. In doing so, he also exposes Sun's pregnancy and Jin's previous sterility to the entire camp, which is...
big yikes.
Yeah. Good news, though, Jack has a plan. Out in the jungle of mystery, John Locke returns to the others with his dead father and shows off his newfound confidence by beating the crap out of Mikhail, which I don't think I approve of. Shortly thereafter, Locke and Ben take a walk out to Jacob's cabin where they find an empty chair, a magical cabin that hates modern technology, and plenty of additional trust issues. It all ends with Ben showing Locke where they dumped all the Dharma bodies after the purge, and then shooting him and leaving him in said pit. Fun fact about this episode, especially for those of you who are big fans of Zack Snyder's DCEU movies... both Ben and Locke have mothers named Emily, so look for that to become a thing later. Also, this is the first episode in Season 3 in which all current cast members appeared in new footage.
Wow.
It did require both Charlie and Desmond to appear without lines, but it happened. Everything else, the previous episodes, there's a lot of archival footage that got used. They finally got the whole gang together, except for Bernard and Rose, apparently. This week's calm question, if you showed up with in the 1970s to the Dharma Initiative and were given a job randomly, what job do you think you would have been assigned? Mine is fairly easy because I'm almost entirely sure that I would either get Roger's job or Mikhail's job. Those are the only two jobs I'm really qualified for.
Neil Workman.
I would be a workman or a man in a cabin who types. He just watches monitors. Yeah, okay.
So now he writes his novel.
Right? I'm curious as to what job you think you would get. We'll start with Joanna. Where's the Dharma Initiative signing you?
I'd like to think that they'd put me in a classroom. So I get to be like a teacher. That's what I would like to do for the Dharma Initiative. So I could be your English teacher. I'm not going to teach you about volcanoes, but I'll teach you about Dante's Inferno.
Nice. Dave, what is the most Dave job of the Dharma Initiative?
Hydroponics. I mean, you got to season all these dishes to feed all these people with something at the very least. Surely they have a greenhouse or something somewhere. It's an island. It feels like hydroponics would be
chicken without some spices, I guess.
That's right.
Spoiler alert. I'm sorry. I'm just going to say this. Spoiler alert. There is a character in the Dharma Initiative, because we've not seen the last of the Dharma Initiative. There's a character in the Dharma Initiative that reminds me of you. And now that you say it, we'll get there.
We'll get to who Dave's real Dharma Initiative identity is.
Speaking of which, I mean, I know we're going to talk about Lost right now, but like, speaking of which, do I believe that Roger got like, you know, Hogwarts hat sorted into workman? Sure. I don't believe Ben would also be sorted as a workman. What do you think? Ben's so smart.
Is it some sort of like generational? You get passed down whatever your dad had? I mean, it's very clear why Roger, because, you know, Horace, who when they show up to the island is in charge, seems like he's in charge.
Yeah.
Horace got his friend, who he feels bad for, because he's having a really tough time dealing with the fact that his wife died after giving birth to his son. Workman. Like, I don't know what Roger's skills are, but that sounds about right.
Can't even work in the hydroponics division.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, how much do you really trust Roger? He's really a mess. But
I mean, there's nothing wrong with janitorial work or whatever. It's just sort of like, actually, yeah, that's another thing I'll say. I'm gonna stop talking about the future of the Dharma Initiative, but like, you can just embrace your Dharma Initiative job, or you can be a real dick about it, or Roger decided to be a real dick about it. So,
well, here's something that's in favor of Ben also being a workman, is if at this point he's been planning his revenge on his father / the initiative for decades, workman is exactly the position I would put myself in if I plan to kill everybody, because he knows where all the gas masks are. Well, he knows where all the stations are. We get a name drop.
Probably has keys to all the closets. And all the
No. We got named after the Pearl Station, which is the one hatch that has not been blown up by John Locke, which means that it's important. But Roger Workman knew where the Pearl Station was, so you know where all the stations are. You know where all the things go. You get to go fuck off and have beer on the Mesa whenever you have a spare chance. I think that Workman is a strategically important job if the goal is tear everything down.
That's a very good point, except I will say one last Darmanship spoiler. There's security. There's a whole security team. So if I were Ben and I wanted keys to all the doors and everything, I would get myself on the security team. So
that's true. Although, in defense of Roger, I guess. Roger, it's really a failure of imagination for him, because he doesn't see how good he really has it on the island.
Totally.
You know, he's part of the janitorial staff, but he also has a home.
And he gets to just drive around this beautiful island in his gorgeous VW van and listen to Three Dog Night.
Yeah.
Like, his job is like Hurley's vacay. So, you know, Roger, no small jobs, only small men, and you are a small man. Welcome to the Bad Dad Olympics, Roger Workman.
Man, comes rolling in to the Bad Dad Olympics. We've had some real strong candidates come bursting through the door like the Kool-Aid Man in the last couple episodes.
Yeah, I mean, this might be a good time, since we've touched on both these topics, to do our two-part official podcast check-in, because there's, I think, two notable things in this week's official Lost podcast. It's the podcast where Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse would answer questions / update the Lost fandom in real time. This podcast aired after The Man Behind the Curtain, and I'll be reading Carlton Cuse, and Neil will be reading Damon Lindelof. Here comes part one. Carlton. Oh, I don't have to say that part. You just know when I speak. We have had a huge week. This was actually as you probably know, we have for a long time been trying to resolve the issue of when we would end the show. And I think everyone has, you know, there's been a lot of anxiety, I think, behind a lot of these questions. You know, do you guys know where you're going? Are you making this up as you go along? Do you have an ending for the show? I mean, what's underlying all those questions is a fear that it's not going to end well, and that...
Or it's not going to end, period.
Or that it will just wither away. You know, it was really important to the two of us that we not end the show after the show was no longer relevant. We didn't want the end. See, there's the ringing phone.
There it is. That's one down.
So we basically, you know, it was really important to us that we could kind of, for many reasons, figure out what the end point was to provide a certain measure of confidence for the fans. You know, we love the J.K. Rowling model, and if you haven't heard specifically, we are going to be doing 48 episodes more of the show, and that's going to break down over 3 seasons of 16 episodes each.
We feel that the story we've got to tell is actually going to go sort of compartmentalize very nicely over that span of time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as we started really focusing on 48 episodes, we started thinking about the remaining story we had, and it kind of did fit nicely into 3 pods of 16 episodes. So we sort of feel that not only kind of in total episodes, but also in structural delivery of the episodes, we're really doing the right thing for the show. End part one. And then at the end of the podcast comes part two.
Fascinating. Hold on to your butts, guys. It's a cliffhanger. What do you think the significance is that Ben was born just outside of Portland? Not in Portland. Like
30-some miles outside of Portland?
Does that matter? Is it full circle to the pilot? Like, I mean, what is... I mean, the season premiere? What do you,
I think Richard obviously gets the joke because he uses it later.
Yeah. Should we talk about Richard?
And his
agelessness? We can talk about Richard. Yeah, which is we could finally talk about now, because Ben makes the joke and we get a flashback, Richard.
You remember birthdays, don't you, Richard? Richard. I mean, is this our Island of Mystery moment? It has to be, right? Jungle Mystery Moment? No. Oh, okay, we got something else. Okay, well, the hot immortal is not our biggest what-the-fuck moment of the episode, I guess.
I mean, it was hard to choose a biggest what-the-fuck moment from this episode, but I do like Hot Richard as just another indication that nothing on this island works like it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. In terms of like people's physical bodies.
I think what I really want to know is what happened in between when Ben was like 8 years old or 10 years old or however he is in that first time they meet and the purge, because when Richard shows up for the purge, he's got the hair cut cropped close again. So mm-hmm. like, why did he give up the hairstyle that was obviously working so well for him in the 70s?
Maybe, so the others, quote unquote, hostiles in the Dharma Initiative, they're having like constant skirmishes as Ben is growing up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the hostiles, they've been on the island for an indeterminate amount of time. They're apparently not Dharma Initiative or weren't until after the purge when Ben splits off. And I think he says a few others, either way, some people get absorbed from the Dharma Initiative. So those two things are at odds. We don't know how long the hostiles have been, or the others have been on the island. So my guess is they finally took over like a station or an outpost, the hostiles, in their battle with the Dharma Initiative. And lo and behold, there's a TV in there, and Richard realizes he's out of style.
Mm, okay.
And he's like, oh, well, I mean, I might as well look better if I'm going to be, you know, bopping around the island.
Yeah. So Kenna does not own mirror.
I don't mind his long hair. I think it's his like pirate shirt that's the problem, not his hair. But but yeah, Richard immortal. Wow. But I just want to double down on my question from last week, which is like, why isn't Richard in charge? Mm-hmm. If Richard has been there for a long time.
Yeah. I mean,
Richard,
I think
can't remember birthdays.
The introduction of the hostiles or the natives or, you know, the I guess what we can now call the real others, because they were there before the Dharma Initiative, or so we're told, is that alone is a really great reveal. The sort of reveal that this group that Ben is leading is not the same as the Dharma Initiative that we've seen and that we've been investigating this whole time, as, you know, like, who's the Dharma Initiative? What does this mean? But I just, like, the Richard thing feels like the cherry on top. Like, this whole question of, like, wait, why isn't this guy aging?
Right.
I remember that very viscerally being a huge deal when it aired and being like, yeah, but also, shouldn't we be asking more questions about, like, the Dharma Initiative and why they needed to be killed off? But it's great. It's just great. It's a great episode of Lost.
Follow up. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
No. I was going to say it's one of the nice little pieces is they have had Richard all season, but then when they lay on the invulnerability, they do like the tiniest bit of world building, which is Richard wears a gas mask, but mostly so he could be the first one to take it off and like test for people.
Yeah.
So it's like he walks out wearing a gas mask. I'm like, oh, maybe he just ages very slowly. And it's like takes off. I'm like, no, you don't put like your highest ranking person to be the first gas mask person unless he's Wolverine and immortal. So nice little world building to the immortal Richard Alpert.
There's another thing in that moment. So this is the episode that Michael Emerson submitted for the Emmys this year. No duh, right? Mm-hmm. He lost to Terry O'Quinn, who won for The Man from Tallahassee. And like something I think we've talked about in the past is like Terry O'Quinn and Michael Emerson are the only two actors who ever won Emmys for Lost. And so Michael Emerson will win in the future. But what's true about all the episodes that they submitted is that usually both of them were in those episodes, because usually like Ben is best when he's playing off Locke and Locke is best when he's playing off Ben. So it's almost like a double submission every time where it's like, you know, because Terry O'Quinn gets, you know, the Emmy voters will look at this episode for Terry O'Quinn as well, sort of thing. So, but
in that case, it's also a pretty great week for John Locke antagonist check-in, at least here in the calm. If we were to find a protagonist of this episode, I think it has to be Ben by the default of you don't watch your villain get berated by his father while he cries, and you know, in a single episode of television.
You're stretching it, because listen, the episode ends with Ben shooting John point blank and dumping him. First of all, Ben committed a genocide and then shot John in the chest and like into a pit of bodies that he was responsible for killing.
Ben did something worse, and this actually is our Giacchino corner this week. Ben committed Dharmacide.
Hey! No.
That is the title of one of the tracks.
You should have said Dharmacide is painless. That would have been better. Ben is obviously the antagonist of this. He's the young Ben can be the protagonist, but Ben now is the antagonist. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and John Locke, he's at the beginning of this episode when he shows up to the other's camp and starts punching Mikhail. John is in a very antagonist zone, but that's only really just about him and Mikhail and their bravado off.
The menacing way he eats a mango.
Right? But once they sort of take the walk out to Jacob's cabin, John is really just along for the ride. And I mean, honestly, if anything wins an Emmy, it's Terry O'Quinn's like, wait, what the fuck face from inside the cabin when they get in there and it's just an empty chair. He's like, just one of the all-time great faces on Lost is him being just genuinely confused about what's going on.
All John is doing this episode is calling Ben a liar, and he's right. Like, over and over and over and over and over again. So,
well, that's why I also like the taking the extra moment in the dialogue for John to be like, do you see a person in the chair? Like, he gives the latitude that maybe he's overestimated Ben. He like gives him a second to like maybe, but then he realizes that, you know, Ben's probably a liar. But he does hear someone say help me. And we haven't seen Henry Gale do any Muppet voices yet, so...
Well, we also see someone in that chair.
Yes, and an eyeball, I believe?
No, not just an eyeball. You see a silhouette.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And it's... I have some storm thoughts about the silhouette. But yeah, it's interesting. Can I zoom back to Richard for a second?
Sure.
Well, two things. Number one, the reason I brought up the Emmy submission thing is because, like, I mean, Michael Emerson's great in this episode. Also, I want to shout out the kid they got to play young Ben, who's super good and like my favorite. I lost his name. Hold on. I just had it. Who's my favorite, like, young version of anyone we see on the show? Not that that's a long list. Sterling Bowman is the name of that kid. I really like him. Michael Emerson's great in this episode, but in that mask scene when, like, Richard pulls his mask off and is like, poison? No, everyone's safe. The way that Michael Emerson pulls his mask off is, like, it's such a choicey move. It's so dramatic, and it's like... It's almost like I'm entering a new world where my dad doesn't exist. I'm breathing the air of the earth where my dad is not here to be like the wrong one dad at me, like, you know, anymore. And it's just like, it's a big move, but Michael Emerson like really makes it work. I really liked a lot.
And it's with that breath of new air that leads to the decision to leave Roger out there.
Right.
Which, you know, great for continuity. Great for our camping crew, because I went back and watched the Hurley starting the van scene several times today. It's just great.
Yeah, the song playing when he then pulls up with Ben to start drinking beers is real, like a real subtle use of foreboding very much enjoyed.
I love our live watches, but I have to say, like, our Stormy sometimes have like a little bit of trouble like keeping chill about things, and so like when he shows up and it says like Roger Workman on his coveralls, I don't know that like every single person would like immediately make that connection, and our Stormies were like, oh hey, Roger Workman, eh? Like blah blah. And I can't blame them for that. That's fine. But I think once Shambhala starts playing, you're like, oh shit, that's definitely Ben's dad, and he's definitely gonna kill him. But yeah, the other Richard thing I wanted to say is that Richard asked Ben two questions about what he sees, which is, did your mom die on the island? And you saw her out here. And I think, yeah. and Ben's answers to those questions makes Richard really interested in him. So
That might be our Jungle of Mystery moment. Ben's mom is on the island in an episode where we get an immortal man and a godhead and a Dharmaside. The most mysterious thing to me is we now have somebody dead on the island whose body hasn't been on the island, right? Because Yemi's corpse is on the island, and we assume Christian Shepherd's corpse is on the island. His empty casket definitely is. So we're just not... I guess the horse. Yeah, the horse's body isn't on the island.
And then, I mean, I guess Dave just never existed. the thing. So,
or was it, you know, the psychic quake of all Daves through time and space?
Did you say the psychic quake of all Daves?
The psychic quake of all Daves.
yeah. Maybe this is the first time we know she died just outside of Portland, thereabouts. So interesting. Fun fact.
She died in something that looked a lot like the jungle.
Yeah.
But wasn't.
Love an island fake out. fun fact for folks who don't know. Carrie Preston is the actress, the great actress who played Ben's mom, Emily. And that is also Michael Emerson's wife. So that's weird, but also fun. Carrie Preston is the best. She's so good on True Blood and so good on The Good Wife, that I'm really sad, that we don't even get even more of her in this episode. She just dies in childbirth and then is a ghost mom. So, she's capable of a lot more. So there you go.
Good old ghost mom. Well, that isn't our only, notable new blonde character actress in this episode.
Samantha Mathis,
hey!
Sweetheart of the 90s, grown up Amy from Little Women, Fumble the Volume, Broken Arrow. Yeah, Samantha Mathis.
Super Mario Brothers
here.
Movie.
You know, that's, I'm sure she'll come back.
Well, that seems like a good time to talk about what she's talking about, which is apparently the island was at one point home to a volcano, which is new information about the island, because we've seen some stuff, and we've seen, like, at least if you've watched that Pixar short film Lava, you've seen some volcano looking mountains that have, you know,
well, I feel
maybe
like in
been
this episode,
singing for their love.
Yeah, I feel like in this episode they made a real effort to shoot the island sort of in similar shots that we've seen before, like when Juliet arrives and stuff like that, which is not just like the sub arrival. There's like also the scene where like little Ben and Annie are sitting in the swing set that you just like see the looming like aspect of the island sort of over them. So yeah.
So we got some new information about the island there. Obviously a ton of stuff about Jacob, but given the nature of, I think, this episode, what we saw, it's hard to call exactly what's a lie and what's truth at this point, because we're so new into poking the open question of the island deity. And I feel like this episode specifically deals with Locke's assertion at the beginning, which is that Ben's the man behind the curtain. There is no Wizard of Oz. And then this episode teases us that maybe there is, right, as a way to distract from Ben actually closing a trap around Locke, which is very clever storytelling, but I don't think it's a way in which either of our characters, Locke, who generally doesn't know what's going on, Ben, who may have a slightly better idea of what's going on, but may also not have no idea what's going on, I don't think you could take any of their statements about Jacob as true. Do you guys think we learned anything true about Jacob?
I think it's hard to say in the calm.
I think that, okay, so this episode does, yeah, it throws us this weird curveball with the cabin scene. But what I was struck by on rewatch, and I think this is worth watching if you're in the calm, is the way everyone reacts when John says, Ben and I are going to go see Jacob.
Richard stands all the way up.
Is at attention. Mikhail is shocked. Everyone is like, wait, what? This is
friendly
so...
cocks a whole eyebrow.
An entire brow up
Tom
the forehead.
Just beside himself. So yeah, it's like this idea of like, I don't know if we learned anything new about Jacob, but he continues to be important to this traveling group of people who follow Ben. It's seemingly because Ben talks to Jacob, right? Like that seems to be the dynamic we're seeing, is like, that's Ben's hold on everybody, is he's the only guy that can talk to Jacob. So when John is like, I'm going to go talk to him, everybody's like, oh shit, like something is happening here. You know?
Well, yeah, and it's not just that. I mean, they've already, you know, they've already like done like defection rumblings to John. Mm-hmm. And then the moment when like John's beating the shit out of Mikhail, Ben's like, Tom, Richard. And they're like, we don't answer to you right now. So cold.
Tom's like, where did I put that recorder?
We're just like, I have to go moisturize. Excuse me.
Yeah, I like the introduction of the idea of there being like a tangible god you could talk to on the island. But again, you just kind of like dive so deep into the performances of both guys. I think it's a way to make you stop thinking super deep questions. Like, why would an all-powerful god on his own mystery island stay in a cabin and only talk to one person? It's all weird. I will say, and maybe in lieu of Joanna giving a calm answer for our calmies, on this week's Official Lost podcast, in the part we're not going to be reading, they say that they will be dealing with the Jacob question, but not to expect it to be dealt with in the remainder of season 3. Mm. So just to set expectations... You got a little Jacob taste, but we're still in the other season, and John Locke's dying of a bullet wound in a hole. So we got other things to deal with before we get back to answering some Jacob questions.
I also think, I mean, like in terms of mythology, what we learn about seeing the Dharma Initiative in its like full swing in the 70s, like, you know, we knew that the Dharma Initiative was like, it had to have been like a little hippy dippy, like the fact that it's called the Dharma Initiative and they say namaste and stuff like that. But like Horace, played by an extremely creepy dude in real life, Doug Hutchinson, who is made a fine career out of playing creeps. Not that we're necessarily supposed to think Horace is a creep, but he's
Could you clarify creepy in real life?
Yeah, I will. He's a famous creep on X-Files, right? And he is famously a creep in The Green Mile.
Okay. So he's an actor who famously plays creeps.
No, about to clarify. And then when he was 51 years of age, Doug Hutchinson married a 16-year-old singer named Courtney Stodden, and they were sort of like tabloid fodder for a while. So actually creepy.
Like the Ferris Bueller principal problem.
Yeah, no, because that I'm well. I was like, that was child pornography. And I'm like, what's a 16-year-old, Joanna? Okay, anyway. Yeah, not great. Basically, that dude sucks. But we did meet Horace, and just like the Horace with his long hair and his tie-dye shirt and saying like being very like crunchy granola to Ben and stuff like that, like I think helps us better understand what the Dharma Initiative was beyond its scientific experiments. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, that leads us into another corner. Where's Libby? This one was my call, because I think she grew up in a happy child outside of Portland, living in Horace's old house. Because you got to imagine that guy has like a house with like floor-to-ceiling windows and a huge backyard where you could like see
so many
the sunset.
Skylights.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of exposed wood. Yeah,
he's got to look at all. So I think I want to think that's Libby's childhood home. Horace decamps to the island, never to return, because he gets gas and a real bad bloody nose. But Libby gets to grow up in his house. That's my Where's Libby.
Libby is somehow related to Samantha Mathis's character.
Ooh. It's all in the blonde.
Yeah.
She's like her niece or something like that.
Yeah, and they were
if all dads could be bad, all blondes could be related.
Do we want to talk about Sawyer and Saeed forming the I Hate Jack Club?
We probably should give some talk to what happened on the beach this week.
Sawyer and Saeed are like, Jack, fuck him. I do really love, so Sawyer's got the tape that he got from John, plays it for Saeed. Saeed's like, oh shit, like, let's expose her, let's not tell Jack what we're thinking because we don't like him or whatever it is. I just want to shout out, like, when Kate comes up, she's like, oh yeah, Jack and Juliet aren't here because blah, blah. And yeah, I told them about Naomi. And then Sawyer just goes, and Saeed goes, and why would you do that? Fucking asshole, Kate. Why would you do that?
That whole sequence is great because then he's just like, let her listen to the tape. And then he's like walking away.
She's, where's Jack? I don't know. Of course you don't. Like, oh, I don't know what Saeed's on, but he's having like a really sassy day. So,
great,
yeah,
stuff. It's a great pairing with Sawyer as well. And then they call their little town meeting and yeah, it's on. I guess. I don't know. It sort of abruptly stops with like Jack being like, well, I haven't made a plan yet. You're going to have to find out what that is next week.
I haven't decided what I was going to do about it yet. And I'm just like, I screamed out loud. I was like, Jack, be less of the worst. I mean, you're like, yeah, you have the slight, you know, you're right, I guess. Right? That he's like, oh, I already knew that. Blah, blah. But I'm like, why don't you tell people?
Well, what I learned from the second worst American president during my lifetime is you don't want to declare yourself the decider. That's a bad look. Like, kings the roll decisions down. Jack needs himself a little round table. He's got a nice little two-night oatmeal table with Juliet, which, again, it still doesn't read trustworthy, because Juliet's story is like, as soon as I saw that ultrasound, I decided to tell Jack. And I'm like, that still seems like we can't completely trust Juliet.
Still
because
feels very late in the process to find yeah, your courage or your, you know, find.
If Jack and Juliet were together, like, from the time they left Otherton, like, fine. But they've been, like, Jack's like, he's under my protection. And then some, like, couple weeks later, she's like, so, thank you so much for the protection and the oatmeal. It's been really great. But I am spying for Ben, and he is coming to kidnap everybody. Like, what it was... If Jack gets so mad when people just tell Kate things, could you imagine how mad Jack would get by being, like, proved wrong? Maybe that's why I didn't tell anybody. Because he's like, then fuck, they'll all realize how much of an idiot I was. My only power move to remain the decider is to keep this information to myself. Ugh. Anyway, but I think that this is half Jack being... At the beginning of the season, Jack definitely had this problem of being, like, toxic through control. As this season rolls on, I feel like Jack is still in that spot, but I put less of the blame on the writers intentionally putting him there, and more... on like just the plotting of this season means that Jack needed to be back on the beach and everybody needed to hate him for 5 episodes, but he couldn't really do anything about it. Not to, you know, let people completely off the hook, but we did just pat Damon on the back for winning an Emmy, so
yay, Damon!
You know, we give with one hand and slap with the other. Beach is about to happen.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of Damon, like, we should shout out sort of the, like, Hebraic implications of the fact that, like, Juliet is supposed to mark the tents with the pregnant women in them, a sort of, like, reverse Passover sort of visual.
How do you think it feels like, wow, Kate, while listening to this? Because I think this is Kate's first time finding out that she is on the list to potentially be stolen, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Check on Austin sort of thing. Yes,
and she's like, fuck, I have been fucking the past few weeks. Oh, man, I really dodged a bullet there.
Yeah.
I'm glad you made that connection without having seen Prince of Egypt, Joanna. That shows.
Listen,
that shows
I am literate. Okay, I've seen the Ten Commandments.
I've only seen cartoons. Most of my Bible knowledge comes from cartoons. That's a lie. Don't judge me on that.
Yeah, but I think it's I think it's interesting. No, I don't remember what I was going to say about that. I can't remember if it's in this episode or the next, but it might be both, where they say the phrase "our women" and "their women" a lot. I don't know if you guys noticed in this episode, if it's not in this one, it's in the next one, but it's like, they're going to take our women. We have to protect our women, like sort of stuff like that. I'm just like, ugh. I mean, like, I know it's centered around like who might be pregnant, but it's just like, look for that phrase. Drink for me if you're watching and drinking at the same time. It just feels very patriarchal. I don't like it.
All it would take is one lampshading scene. I mean, like, there are women. Well, our womb, our people who, no, never mind. All right. Let's get to some more corners here. Neil, we're going to pick up with our official podcast check-in part two. Yes. Neil starts this one as Damon Lindelof.
All right, Carlton. I'm going to bring it down a little bit of a serious... this is my final question.
I thought that was a serious question. Lay it on me, baby.
And I quote, "Daddy Love Me Syndrome," posted by Coot421. That's 31 posts in the last 90 days. And I quote again, "Tonight's episode was good, but seriously, what's with this ongoing theme? Locke, Jack, Hurley, etc., and now Ben. Is everything all right with both of you at home? If disappointments can't be mended by both of you being part of a hit TV show, I don't think anything will solve them. That's the question."
I'm laughing on the outside, but I'm crying on the inside.
Oh my God, our lives are so miserable.
Oh, geez. You know, there's no easy answer to that question.
If anyone out there actually has an awesome relationship with their father, please let us know all about it, and we will...
Write us so that we could share that vicariously.
Yeah, we will create a character on the show who has an awesome relationship with their father and has slightly more interesting than... and has slightly more interesting than a can of paint.
And scene. Bad dad syndrome finally called on it.
Okay.
I got confused there at the end.
Yeah, a can of paint. I don't know what happened. speaking of bad dads, can we do our Henry Gill Obviously Alive Award?
Absolutely. We can. What is that, Joanna?
Okay, so the Henry Gill Memorial Obviously Alive Award. There's so many actual Ben Linus lies in this episode. Like, you could have said almost anything that Ben said in this episode, you'd be all set. But I asked that this week we nominate good old Alex for her happy birthday, Dad. She doesn't wish his birthday is happy at all.
No.
So
she's like, hey, John, take this gun.
Here, John, here's this gun.
Happy birthday, I like is Dad. That... We're finally getting to the point where people are starting to get revenge on bad dads. So yeah. Like last week it was Sawyer, and this week it's just Alex. And honestly, this is a pretty good revenge, is handing John Locke a gun and then like laying one pithy comment on him and walking away.
I mean, also, Roger got his this week.
That's true. Yeah. So bad dads are falling all over the place. The rise of ghost moms is on.
The rise of ghost moms.
I do love that Ben is like, oh, you think it was, John, you think it was tough of me to ask you to kill your dad? Guess what? I committed dharmacide.
Killed everyone.
All the dads.
I think it's definitely the dawn of ghost moms. Because why did you say that name? Mm-hmm. All right,
Emily.
What did he say to you, Locke?
Emily.
Oh God, let me help you out of that hole. I didn't realize we were on the same side.
I can't believe they played Who's on First when Locke was in a pit of skeletons. Like, when is a skeleton pit a time for a bit? I don't know. I don't feel like it is.
Well, it is the Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award for this week, because John Locke fell into a pit. Shot in the gut, fell in the pit, and surely we won't be seeing him again. That's why this entire podcast has been us talking about the character of Locke and me bringing it to a grand conclusion about how he absolutely was the antagonist.
John Locke died, and he was...
He died. The thing I beeped out of Terry O'Quinn earlier in the podcast was died in a pit. So there, now you guys know what was beeped out. Congratulations. I think it's time for some more fun with Kistery. That's our corner where we let you vote via our Twitter account on who needed to do some kissing each episode. Joanna, how did we do last week?
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you. Unfortunately, our guy Jin, who had a 2-week winning streak going, was not up for the win this last week. So mm-hmm. unfortunately, someone came in to break Jin's 2-week streak. Our Jungle of Kistry moment, this is nominated by our listeners for the most part who are watching on our live watches, and then we put the poll up on Twitter and you can vote. There's a real debate raging in our Slack right now whether inanimate objects should be allowed in because people are tired of inanimate objects winning. But I like when inanimate objects win. So anyway, 16% of the vote this week went to Locke and Rousseau. That's a shame. I really liked that one. 19% of the vote this week or last week went to Saeed and Naomi. 29.4% of the vote went to Locke and Richard. But 35% of the vote... went to Saeed and the radio. That's week 3 for an Asian man winning the Kistry poll. Saeed and his fondness for technology, the radio, reinforced this week when Sawyer's like, take a look at this. And hands Saeed a tape recorder. And Saeed's like, more
ooh,
technology.
A tape recorder.
anyway, so Saeed and the tape recorder are not on the episode, on the list this week, but here we go. I submitted one this week. I'm submitting Richard and Moisturizer. That's my nomination.
Yeah, whatever aloe plants he's finding on the island has the best shit.
He took over my hydroponic station and cut his hair.
Tiffany's voting for the Emmy boys. That's Locke and Ben. I said Emmy boys, but I could have said Emily boys. Anyway, Locke and Ben spent a lot of quality time together this episode. Steph nominated Ben and dramatic field trips.
Ben and bunnies and dramatic field trips.
No, I put bunnies in there.
Oh, nice.
I added bunnies because please let us not forget the shot of young Ben cuddling a bunny in bed. So, you know, Ben and his bunny affections are real. But Steph pointed out that Ben just like loves to take someone somewhere and be like, and see? and then lastly Fainting Violet, I don't know that listener's non-username, but they nominated Sawyer and Saeed and the I Hate Jack Club. So Sawyer and Saeed conspiring over a tape
making out underneath a flag with Jack's face in a line through
Juliet's tarp.
The tape recorder is still kind of involved in that one.
It's true. Do what you gotta do. Vote Richard and Moisturizer. Thank you.
All right. And with that, we are going to lead in our interview. Joanna, who are you talking to this week?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. This week, we have a great guest. They are a host of another Lost podcast, the Lost Boys podcast. So I talked to the great Jacob Stolworthy. And it was interesting for me to talk to him because, like, Jacob has a different... Not only is his name Jacob and his co-host on that podcast, his name is Jack Shepherd, but...
Really?
Yeah, really.
Wow.
I was just interested to learn a little bit more about, like, how, like, UK fans think about Lost. So, Jacob's a writer for The Independent, co-host of this podcast. They're, I think, in season 5, I want to say. But they've got, like, Jack is watching for the first time, and Jacob is a longtime fan, and that's their dynamic. So here is our chat with Jacob. The spoiler section of that chat will be a bonus episode that we will drop for our Patreon subscribers later this week. That's at, I believe it's $10 level or above, gets you, like, our spoiler chats. So, go ahead and sign up to the Patreon for that full chat if you haven't already. Hey, Dave, I have a quick question for you.
Yeah, Joanna.
Is there anything interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals in 2020?
Oh, is there? Man, I mean, the nation's political structure is in peril. And, my parents are at risk for a deadly worldwide pandemic, and Taco Bell is canceling the Mexican pizza.
No, but have you heard about their jalapeno Pinot Noir? It's a real thing. Look it up. Okay. Anyway, there's a lot to be distressed by. I'm putting jalapeno Pinot Noir at the top of the list, but you can decide where your personal ranking is. And BetterHelp is here to assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist to help you through these really trying times. You can start communicating in 48 hours, and this is not a crisis line, and it's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. The folks who work for BetterHelp have a broad range of expertise, which may not be locally available in many areas, and the service is available for clients worldwide.
You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor. You'll get a timely and thoughtful response. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed. It's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today.
You can visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily on betterhelp.com/reviews. Here's one that caught my eye, and this is for Dr. Isabel Moreno. Dr. Moreno has helped me to work through a very difficult time. She also assisted me with recognizing things that are deeply embedded, that were lost, that needed to be dealt with. So, you know, you can find those things that you have lost. To do so, you can visit betterhelp.com/storm. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P. Join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. So what you're going to do is you're going to go to betterhelp.com/storm, and our listeners can get 10% off your first month. Again, that is betterhelp.com/storm.
We are thrilled to welcome back from, you might have heard him on our anniversary podcast that we did. It is Jacob Stillworthy, a writer for The Independent, co-host of the Lost Boys podcast. Hello, Jacob. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing?
Doing well. We talked about this a little before we started recording. It's weird to say we're doing well. It's strange times.
Strange times indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. But we are here to talk about a fantastical escape to an island, which is something we could all hope for in 2020. Mm-hmm. And you specifically wanted to do this episode. So let's talk about Ben. Let's talk about the man behind the curtain. Let's talk about this episode. So this is a huge episode for as you say, for lore. We learned so much. We learned about what happened with the Dharma Initiative.
Yes, we did. Oh, my God.
And we get, my co-host Neil, I think, referred to this final stretch of season 3 as like, what do you call it? The dad bad palooza or something like that. Yeah. Right? We've just dispatched Anthony Cooper, who is like our number one bad dad.
Yeah.
And then of course we get to meet Roger Workman. So like even villains have bad dads on this show. So yeah. So what, like how does the, for you, I don't know if you can recall watching it for the first time or even just watching it now, what does learning about this side of Ben do for your relationship with that character?
It's huge. I think contextualizing Ben Linus's, I mean, even beginning to contextualize his behavior, I don't know how they even dreamed his story up and how that we might kind of feel sorry for him and understand and be like, yeah, okay, get it now. But I think this episode does it really well. I think I needed this episode to love Ben the way I ended up loving Ben. I think they absolutely nailed the casting for the child who played him. Just generally speaking, I find his backstory very heartbreaking. And while I don't agree with his methods and what he does in the present day,
sure.
You know, if I did, you probably wouldn't be wanting to speak to me. He does a good job at kind of, you know, just kind of letting you know this guy's deal and how he didn't really have the best start or indeed continuation into life.
Yeah, so the kid who plays him is Sterling Bowman, and this is, you know, no major spoiler, but not the last time we'll see him. And I think this kid is great. I think this kid is really great. He does such a good job. They did such a good job casting for someone who could give you that, like, wide-eyed, you know, Michael Emerson stare where you can, like, see all the gears going inside his head behind those, like, baby blue eyes. It's really effective.
It really is. Casting. Yeah. He's just like you want to give him a cuddle, but then you're also like, this boy is, there's something lurking underneath that. You just know, you know there is. You're like, I'll give you a little pat on the head and run away.
From a distance.
Yeah.
yeah, because, you know, it's not like, you know, killing his father is one thing. Gassing the Dharma Initiative is, you know, the bridge beyond that. That feels like you're watching this kid. He's abused as a child. This comes from abuse. But like, you can't, you know, if he had killed his father in a moment of like self-defense or anger boiling over, whatever, you'd be like, oh, that's disturbing. But like, you know, I kind of get it. He was abused, so he lashed out. I get it. But no, Ben being the extra, you know, person that he is, has to commit a mass murder at the same time.
Yeah, and like a really, really kind of like carefully planned one. And just like, yeah. It's just in Ben's keeping, isn't it? It's not like this kind of like Michael Douglas falling down, like click, right, I'm going to kill everyone today. It's like, I'm going to just like while away at this plan. And then on my birthday, it's all going to go down. Yeah, it's in keeping with Ben, absolutely, for it to be that way.
And then it's, of course, this interesting payoff for the earlier episode, Trisha Tanaka is dead. We get this, like, this thing that we, that was a centerpiece of what is considered one of the most joyful episodes of Lost, becomes, like, really chilling. Not that it wasn't chilling, the fact that there was a skeleton in that van, but you can make up all kinds of nice stories about Roger Workman and like how he went, and you're like, oh, you know, old age in the van, who knows, you know, yeah. Whatever, but it's like, no, here's the scene of a patricide is where this nice little Hurley episode took place.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine that's where it's going to go when you see Sawyer basically cheersing Roger's skeletal head. So silly. And also, like, I love the moment where Ben goes, where Richard says, should we go out and get his body? And he's like, no, leave him out there. And I think that's, you know, that just, like, it's like the cherry, the evil slash really chilling cherry on top of the whole ordeal is that he's like, nah, I don't know, I'll just let his body rot.
Right. And even, and Richard's like, damn.
Yeah. He's like, what have we created?
Right, and then of course this is also the fascinating reveal of Richard Alpert's, shall we say, suspiciously ageless quality in this episode.
I think that's a good way of putting it. yeah, right, we get a hint though when he's like, you do remember birthdays, right? And then you're just a bit like, okay. And then later on when you see him with his cool Sawyer-esque hair,
yeah,
but just like exactly the same face, you're like, okay, this guy is clearly, yeah, there's something going on here.
He's been around for a while, we don't know how long. Yeah, I just think I'm so curious to know, you know, because they bring Nestor Carbonell in early as like, you know, a bit of a Ben Linus henchman or whatever. And I'm just, I don't know if you know the answer to when they decided that Richard Alpert was not only going to be like, you know, like a Tom Friendly type figure, but like much, much more, you know?
From what I understand, I think it was news to Nesta as well until like season 4 hit. And he was like, okay, they're going to bring back next season for like a bit, like a lot more, basically. I love that they did that. I think one of the reasons why I love the back half of season 3 is this kind of slowly pushing forward of Richard, because he's just a good he's a solid presence, that guy, isn't he? Yeah. And throw in the whole, I mean, as I said, this episode, that I love I love the mythological aspect of loss, and throwing in a potentially ageless person is like quite mystical.
Yeah.
So it ticks that box. It ticks that box very nicely.
A new thing the island could do, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Add it to the list. Yeah, I'm curious. Watching this, and you know, we just watched The Brig, like trying to reconcile what they're trying to do at this point in season three with the others, because I think, you know, when this season starts, you know, it opens on Juliet hosting book club in like the other's suburbia of the Lost Island, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a big iconic moment for the show, because before that we were given to understand, like, you know, they called these characters the jungle creeps. Like, these were like creepy, you know, folks who lived in the jungle with dirty clothes and stuff like that. And then season three has a bit of a retcon where, like, you know, Tom's beard is fake and they've got book club and they've got, you know, indoor plumbing, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And it seems like with Juliet and everything they do with her this season, we're trying to make the others less of like a source of evil menace and more of a like, hey, it's complicated, we have altruistic reasons for doing some of the things we do, you know, that sort of stuff like that. But then you get stuff like The Brig and this where it's like, okay, but also the others are perfectly okay with like mass slaughter of the Dharma Initiative or watching Locke kill his dad possibly in the middle of like
yeah, with
field
kids
somewhere.
Running out. Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, I don't know where you land with season three others and like where we're supposed to put them on the like moral spectrum, you know?
It's a really good point. I think delving into them and learning that there are some like quite, you know, cultish sensibilities to their existence is no surprise, but also it does confuse after the whole Juliet stuff. I think for me, the Dharma Initiative killing is just fully convinces me that, you know, the others just, they can't be good people. Like, that you just can't, when you kill off an entire community of people, you just can't be good. And I know there's probably good people among them, and I think we do learn that Juliet, and we, you know, we get the backstory, and you know, she's another because of circumstance and nothing else. But with the Dharma twist, it's such a huge moment to kind of understanding that the others, you're not going to have this like revelation and be like, oh, the others are like quite good, and actually us, you know, when you're like, our survivors have actually killed more of them than the others have killed them, so actually they're good people, really. And it's like, no, they've killed so many more people. So that while I love to death Tom Friendly and others who have appeared, you know, they're not good people, are they?
They're not. No. They're foundation. They're this era of the others, because they predate, you know, Ben and all that sort of stuff. But this era of the others is founded on a genocide, and a genocide of hippies.
A genocide is a bit Manson, isn't it? And also, I mean, like, what I find funny is, while that is the case, and obviously not to delve into spoilers or anything, but the others, because they're such a big part of the early era of the show, when they do reoccur, and, you know, I think it's no spoiler to say that there are times where they do reoccur in the show, it's almost like, oh, it's like a warm blanket, like the old comfortability of the others, because you're just like, there's all this other stuff going on, and then you're like, oh, and the others, of course, like an old friend showing up, and you're like, oh no, wait, genocide, just no.
All right, genocide. And I mean, like, the Dharma Initiative has its own culty vibe to it, its own, like, Jonestown vibe to it. But, you know, it's, it's complicated. And I guess that's, maybe I should stop struggling so much. It's just like, yeah, there is a line in season three where it's like, you've killed more of them than they've killed of you. And it's like, yeah, but Ethan broke every bone in Scott Steve's body.
Yeah.
Like every bone. And then later we meet Ethan and he's like fixing Juliet's plumbing. And I'm like, you can't put a shine on Ethan Rum. Like, I'm sorry, I'm terrified of him always.
He took pleasure in the act, and yeah, our guys were merely protecting or avenging. Right. In their case. And then you've also got bloody Mikhail, who is just he's like a bloody Bond villain, isn't he?
No, he's my favorite.
He is good. I love him. I mean, Jack kept calling him Miguel, so I now call him Miguel, which is not helpful for anyone, but yeah.
No, the unkillable Mikhail, I'm a big fan of him. I love how they use him in season 3. It's really, really good.
It is good, isn't it? Yeah.
When you think about this episode, is there a moment or is there a scene or a performance that, like, sticks out to you as, like, the defining element of this very classic episode of Lost?
Good question. I would say that the pretty much every Ben and Locke interaction, I just love that through it all, there's like Locke is flexing, basically like, yeah, like you're going to take me and I'm in charge here now. And Ben is just like, yeah, no, I'm going to get the upper hand ultimately here. And I think probably it comes to a head in the closing scene. Is that okay if I jump to the closing scene and use that?
Absolutely.
As a setup?
Go for it.
I love when he guns locked down after showing him the grave. And he's just like, it just all boils down to this line. What did he say to you? And you're just like, oh, Dan, Ben is so out of touch with everything going on here. Ben knows it, we know it, and, you know, hell hath no fury than a clueless Ben. and then Locke's like, help me, and he's like, John, I'm not going to say it again. And I love that, like, misunderstanding. He's like, no, he said help me. And it just makes you think that, you know, like, you think Ben, despite all the bad things he's done, would probably spare like the likes of Locke or the likes of Jack or the likes of whoever now. And I don't know what gives me that feeling. I don't know if everyone else feels this, but I feel like he's like not an ally in a way, but like he wouldn't just leave them to die in a ditch like that. And when he does that with Locke, it's like, in terms of Ben Linus's character, all bets are off. And I know, obviously, we've got the whole plan that is happening with Juliet's recorder, which I'm sure we'll talk about. So this is like peak Ben villain. But I do feel like with Locke anyway, there's like some form of communion with them. And here it's like, yeah, no, there ain't. Ben will literally kill anyone and everyone if he thinks or feels that they know more about him than to what's going on. I think it's
right,
huge.
And that just goes back to like, that's just daddy issues again, right? Like Jacob being the ultimate daddy and Ben being like, you know, he's talking to you and not me. Like, dad God is giving you attention and not me. What the hell?
It's in dad God. I love it. It's so true. And it's also like Locke, you know, he set Locke this task of killing his dad because, you know, Ben killed his dad. And like, you know,
right,
you know, you can't join you don't have the stones to join the kill your dad club. And then Locke's just done it. And he's like, oh God, he's actually stepping up to the mark here more than I'd like. It's huge. And just in general, obviously the Jacob scene, which I'm sure we'll discuss, the lengths he'll go to kind of like create this facade that he knows or he's in touch with this part of the island is really disturbing.
Let's talk about the Jacob scene.
Okay, cool.
And your interpretation of what's happening in this episode.
So I just think that Ben, it's all a show. I think Locke even says it. It's a show, and Ben takes him in and just is like, yeah, I'm going to like literally pretend there's someone in the chair here, and you know, in his inner monologue, so I'm going to make, yeah, Locke's going to buy this. I'm going to pretend. And then it all goes, obviously, it goes a bit south. And there is someone in the chair and Locke can hear them or whatever. And Ben is shaken. That's my reading of it. That Ben is just kind of playing along. And then it's like, oh no, wait a minute. This is really scary and creepy. Something's happening.
And that something, there's something that John can see that Ben can't.
Yeah.
And Ben is afraid that this is confirmation that Locke is the new anointed leader of the island and his time is over.
Yeah.
Sort of. the conversations that they've been having around, like, Ben's cancer wouldn't be there if he were the leader, and John wouldn't have been, you know, John's legs wouldn't be working if he weren't the leader and stuff like that. So these are just, like, it's not just a political campaign. It's signs from the island that Locke is a chosen one and Ben isn't.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it, I just think it doesn't even cross Ben's mind that anything will go down in that cabin. I think he knows he's got no choice but to take Locke to the cabin, because Locke's not going to take no for an answer. And I think he just really insults Locke's intelligence by, well, you know, I say insults intelligence. To us, he's insulting John's intelligence. But I guess when you are Ben Linus, I'm trying to get myself into the mind of him, which is really hard to do. But you're probably going to try and fob him off with a show like he does. And then when that all bets are off, it's like, okay, Locke is the guy now, and I need to get rid of him.
Yeah. No, it's, Ben needs to be the number one son. you know, like, I mean, that's the thing, is like, he has this terrible experience with his dad, the kid. Hmm. And so he latches on to this promise of, you know, an entity that will care for him. Hmm. And he's latched onto Jacob. Maybe he should have latched onto Richard instead. I don't know. But he latches onto Jacob. And so this idea that he is shut out and John is in is unbearable to him.
It's basically taking away his purpose, isn't it? That's what it seems like.
All right. So do you want to talk about Juliet and the tape recorder and everything that happens there?
I also love this aspect of the episode, because it's the first time that all the characters kind of come back together. They've been quite split on the beach, haven't they? Since Jack brought Juliet back. And I think this is the one where, you know, while we delve into the mystery of the island, it tears along at a pace in terms of the what's going to happen in a few episodes. And I love that showdown when you realize that Jack is like got a plan and he's like, he's being a quiet hero for a change. It's pretty bad.
Okay. I'm going to push back on. Is Go he on. Being a quiet hero, or is he being a withholding dick who like is the only one who gets to have the information?
It's because, a good question. Go on.
Because at the end of last week's episode, at the end of the break, right, Kate comes over and she's like, listen, there's this parachutist here. No one wants to tell you because nobody trusts you anymore. You've got a problem in the camp, blah, blah. And then Julia's like, we should tell her. Jack's like, nah, for no reason. For no reason. Like, why wouldn't you tell Kate in that moment?
That is a good moment. Here, his defense is, I didn't decide what to do about it yet, but I guess he could have just been like, hey guys, look, there's something really awful that's going to happen, and I know you all think I've done a deal with the devil, but I haven't, and I'm coming up with a plan, but it does involve killing them. So don't worry, he should probably affirm the others. I agree with you there. Fair enough. You push back and I'm like, I'm on board.
Jack just has, ultimately good intentions. I think it's just wildly frustrating execution often, and not just from a like it's 2020 and the character of Jack doesn't work as well for me as it did once, and that's true, but it's also it's like frustrating from a narrative point of view, because he's often an obstacle for the narration, an obstacle they need for the narration. But like Jack's decision about who gets to know what when, and the withholding of information, you know, and keeping certain people in the dark is something that the writers use over and over again as like an obstacle. Like if everyone on the beach knew everything all the time, was working together all the time, I feel like there would be a lot less murder.
Yeah. it would be less morbid for them all. That is true. It's interesting because obviously season 3 is the first time that we kind of have, where Jack's kind of like kept from us a little bit. And, we're out of the loop as well. And it really kind of convey the fracture of the group well when you see, you know, Saeed's like, no, don't go to Jack. Like it's quite sad to see when the others aren't trusting him. It makes me really sad actually, because it makes me nostalgic for the time where Jack was the guy everyone could turn to and feel safe with. I get what you mean. I feel like, yeah, I think I just love that line where he's like, I haven't realized what I was going to do about it yet. And this there are a few things to come that I love, like a few good Jack lines, right? It's a bit badass. So I kind of am blinded by that, I think. You're completely right, and I think Jack...
I understand. I mean, like, having gone through the journey with Jack, like, I'll just say, like, I don't know if you've experienced it all with your listeners who are watching for the first time, but our listeners watching for the first time, like, straight up hate Jack Shepard.
Interesting.
which is just a fascinating experience, and it's like, I can see, there's many times when I can see it from their perspective. And then I also do have the extra benefit of having seen his whole journey, and that has to like flavor, you know, if someone's in the like lowest part of a journey, but you know where it's going. You know, you tend to view them a little bit more sympathetically or favorably maybe. And you know, but that's, it's just been an interesting experience for our listeners. They also don't like Charlie, you know, so it's been a real reckoning for some of the men of Lost, with our listeners.
I have to say, watching back, this time around, Charlie is, yeah, he's more and more insufferable with each viewing, I think.
Yeah.
Isn't he? Yeah. It's mad, because I used to love him so much. It's insane.
I know.
It's kind of sad.
What were we thinking? I don't know.
It's mad. It's mad. No, Jack, I completely understand it. I think there are totally some Jack moments where I like flat out despise his decision in that moment, which I'm sure you'd be the same. I won't say it for spoiler purposes, but yeah, I get what you mean, and I understand why some people don't love him as much. It is just a shame, because I do think you do kind of need to love the character or get on board of the character for enjoyment of the series as a whole.
It might, you know, and we'll see what happens towards the end. I do think, thankfully, Lost is such a rich ensemble show that there is just like, there's something there for you.
There really is.
Even if it's not Jack, you know what I mean? There is something there.
You can hitch your ride with someone else much cooler.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, Michael Emerson as Ben Linus, we've talked about this ad nauseum already on the show, but it's so hard to imagine the show without him.
Yeah.
Like, I watching Lost, you know, one week at a time, I'm impatient for his arrival. I'm like, Lost isn't Lost until Ben Linus is here, you know, and then he's like here. And of course, it's very, you know, we've discussed it on the show, it's very well known that he was only supposed to be there for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they just liked Michael Emerson so much, they kept him. But like watching an episode like this, which is so iconic and so good, and you're like, you can't do this without Michael Emerson. Like, what would they have done? So
it is one of them, like, those fortunate kind of turns of fate that Emerson guest starred and then they kept him on. I think you're completely right. Without Emerson, Lost wouldn't be what it became. There are so many episodes. Even now, we're up to season 5 on the Lost Boys, and he is pretty much the MVP of every episode he's in. He really is. There's no denying it. And I just love Ben. Just imagine Ben being played by anyone else. It just wouldn't work, would it?
You can't.
It just wouldn't work. You can't even imagine it. It's, and even that scene in the cabin when he's like, you know, essentially acting to an empty chair, having a conversation with someone who isn't there. That must be so hard to do. I don't even, you know, he does it so well. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I'm curious, you may not have an answer to this, and that's fine if you don't, but I wanted to ask you anyway, like, can you sense a difference between the Lost fandom in the UK and the Lost fandom in America? Like, being a British Lost fan, is it, you know, does the general culture view it differently there? Like what have been any observations you might have around that?
I think that, well, I'm forever like putting my hair out, before COVID down in the pub, when that was a normal thing, like defending Lost, because I think over here, I think there was a lot of consternation because Lost began and it was like one of the first US shows. I think it was that and Desperate Housewives, to get like prime time placement on one of our main channels and like posters and big adverts and stuff, like specially made adverts for the UK. But the problem with lost was that it moved to a channel where you had to have a subscription service after the first two seasons. So a lot of people stopped watching it and just kind of would...
interesting.
Yeah.
It was on Sky?
Exactly, moved to Sky. Yeah. And people would go like, oh, yeah, it meant Sky, and I start watching it. Like, the amount of people who even say it to me now. And then when I go, why won't you, like, start up again? Like, were you enjoying it? They're like, oh, yeah, but like, I heard it, like, just petered off, and they made it up, so they went online. You know, all these kind of, like, things that they've read from, dare I say, misguided individuals. you know, and in their head, it's just this show that kind of, like, went on and on and on and on for, like, nine seasons, and no one liked the ending, and blah, 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 instead of kind of knowing the history that, like, kind of lost, like, changed the way, like, TV was consumed in terms of the, you know, getting an end date and all that. So I think in America, I'm sure you have people like that in America as well, in terms of, oh, it went on and it didn't end well. But I'd say we have a lot more over here because of it being poached by Sky, which has caused me years and years of grief.
That's so interesting. Years, yeah, went behind a paywall. I didn't realize that.
It's mad though, because the amount of people I do, it's all on Amazon Prime over here now, and I say, mm-hmm. You know, we go down the pub and people go, you know, I'm very much, if someone loves a TV show, I will watch it, and I will want to kind of compare it with Lost or compare it with other shows. Like, I've got a friend who is obsessed with Buffy, and I'd never seen it until like this year, because he was like, it's my Lost, you know, I love it.
Yeah. And my Lost as well.
Is it that you love it? And it's funny because I mean, I love it, and I've done that, and I've got one left of Angel now as well. So I've really like committed. But the guy who said it to me, he like still hasn't watched Lost.
No, yeah, not fair.
It's not fair, and it really winds me up, because I feel like he even watched a few, and he was like, yeah, I just don't have any faith that this isn't gonna like string me along. And I'm like, surely me telling you that, you know, isn't my word good enough? But I think there is a real block for a lot of people who think that Lost became like total rubbish.
Yeah, and what's going to be interesting is, like, you know, we started this podcast right when Game of Thrones ended, and one of the reasons we used to be a Game of Thrones podcast.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that we did is because the Thrones ending was so calamitous to the fandom that we were like, okay, let's look at Lost, which went through a similar thing. I love the ending of Lost, but like went through a similar thing reputationally, in terms of if I tweet about Lost even now, I will get someone in my mentions being like, oh, too bad that show just went shit at the end, you know. And I'm like, oh, it didn't. Oh, you know. You know. And I'm curious. I don't know that I'll ever – I don't think my opinion about the ending of Game of Thrones is going to change. Mm. It'll probably soften a little bit, but I don't think it's going to change. But I'll be curious if that'll be a barrier of entry for people in the future considering to watch Game of Thrones. If they're like, well, I heard it ended horribly, so why should I even start it? And I'm like, no, I still want you to watch
the first four to five
seasons of Game of Thrones, man.
It's a really good point, actually. My hunch is that it probably will, especially with Thrones, because it was such a highly publicized like critical reception.
Yeah.
It was like even people who haven't watched an episode or you wouldn't even consider it, like, oh yeah, everyone hated that ending, surely.
Yeah,
at least with Lost we have some, like, me and you and I, some, you know, people who love the finale.
Well, what's funny is I, you know, talking to the people who covered it regularly at the time, as I did for the anniversary podcast, they all, even at the time, loved the Lost finale. So I'm like, where did this myth
drop?
I'm like, you know, that like it was a tremendous failure. I know a lot of people were dissatisfied with it, and that's fine. Like, you can be dissatisfied with the ending of Lost. It's fine. But like, I don't know that it was the across the board failure that like history has decided it was. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
it's kind of, we're being told that it was a divisive finale, when actually you get those people, but those are just trolls who just don't, you know, when people who just go, oh yeah, it was this. And it's like, have you actually even watched it? You're just going by what you've heard. But what I really, really implore anyone who's listening, who might be a writer or a journalist or whatever, when you do the inevitable kind of like worst finales of all time list, keep Lost off, because that just, it renders the list obsolete. It just renders it obsolete. And it's like, this is like, I'm trying to save these people from humiliation, because Lost is, there are so many worse finales than that, aren't there?
Don't embarrass yourself by putting Lost on your list. do Dexter instead.
Yeah, exactly. Just you know, Dexter 1 to 10. Just like literally each placement. It deserves it. It deserves it.
Well, thank you for joining me. Where can folks find you and the Lost Boys podcast?
Oh, God. I'm on Jacob_Stull on Twitter. And Lost Boys Pod is Lost Boys Pod, at Lost Boys Pod. And we are just, we've just had our, well, we're just about to release our 100th episode.
All right. Now is the time on the storm where we, your hosts, like to thank you, our listeners, who subscribe to our Patreon at the $10 level or above. We have bunch of newbies this week. So welcome all in to Courtney Swanson, Rushi, Erica Dawn Rivero, Akil Kasum, Elizabeth Maxenter, Elizabeth Jelly or Gelly, Jess Paul, Kayla Hagman, Ryan DeJule, Nicholas Barclay, or Barclay, Catherine Lemarice, Will Nazer, Taylor Hughes, T. LeDieu, Alyssa Love, Savio Nguyen, Georgia O'Brien, Eleanor Corkish, and Alejandro Villarreal. Welcome to all of you, or also hello if you've been around a while.
I've got some re-upping people we are endlessly thankful for. I would like to thank Rachel Aluli, Cassidy, Leia Rock, Nicholas Ng, Elizabeth Hines, Nikki Jones, Brian Moon, Brett Gordon, Simon, Renee Nye, my mother Liz Gonzalez, Deanna, Jeffrey Post, Sarah Bausman, Marcus Massiarelli, Samba Muteba, Greg Jagger, Nathan Bodnar, Stephanie Hoffman, and Lawrence Ackleton. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Jeff Ziegler, Connor Mufich, Amy H., Kate Dilligan, Sean Duane, Stacy Taxon, Debbie DeNice, Randy Elaine, Jen, Rich Lyman, Moira Burke, Rachel Matusik, Rami Quiton, okay, close enough, Jeff Cooper, Angelica Flunker, Christopher Holmquist, Alicia Gressla, Elliot Goldbaum, hey Elliot, Dharma Jess, and Darth Fishius. Thank you all very much for being members of the Small Council.
And we're back for the storm. I'm here to say Locke's the antagonist. Neil's here to say Juliet's the antagonist. Both of us have good arguments, but I think Joanna is right that Ben's the antagonist.
There should be like a rhyme for that, like, do a genocide, no one's on your side, something like that. Like, the age-old story.
No one likes a genocide.
Can we kick off with this email from Matthew, who, like, okay, you know, like, my plan for this storm section was to talk to you about the cabin and my questions. And Matthew, being, like, one of our greatest, most, like, lore-soaked, diligent listeners, anticipated that we would have, you know, like, he just sent the kind of email that we should receive in response to the way in which we were probably going to, like, bungle through this conversation. And he's like, don't worry, I got you.
I'm assuming you guys are going to be wrong, and forgive me, but...
So you want to hear Matthew's email?
Let's go for it.
It's called The Grand Unified Cabin Theory. All right. Hi, host. The cabin has always seemed to me like one of the most inconsistent aspects of the show, where the rules seem to be different every time it appears. Part of this is the writers changing their minds. For example, the audio commentary for this episode makes it pretty clear that it is supposed to be Jacob in the cabin in this episode, but this is made pretty much impossible by what we see in season 4. So here's my attempt to come up with a theory for the cabin that more or less fits with everything we see. I put some explanations and footnotes to try to cut it down a bit. Oh no, there's footnotes. Okay, it's fine. It's fine. All right. Sometime before the Purge, Horus and maybe Dharma built the cabin. Footnote 1. In Cabin Fever, we see Horus suggesting that the cabin is built as a retreat away from Dharma, but that's really the Man in Black giving Locke a vision, so we don't strictly speaking know whether that's true. Oh no, I always thought Horus' ghost was real. Oh no. Okay.
Yeah, his body's on the island.
All right. But he's like looping in a weird way that like the Man in Black doesn't usually like loop. I just wish.
But Michael doesn't loop. He's a sentient ghost.
here's my issue with the ghosts on the island, including Ben's ghost mom. It's just not consistent, and it makes me bananas. All right.
Yeah, make sense, ghosts, Joanna yells at the heavens.
I do. If I believed in the heavens. All right.
That was the thing that you had to correct from Make Sense Ghosts.
Continuing with Matthew's email. Somehow the cabin acquires the magical properties of the island. That is, the cabin moves around on the surface of the island in the same way that the island moves on the surface of the earth. Jacob isn't happy with Dharma having that kind of power, so through Richard, he arranges meetings with them to tell them they have to stop. He doesn't want to reveal his location in the foot of the statue, so they meet in the cabin. A circle of ash is placed around the cabin to keep the man in black out. Dharma refuses Jacob's demands, and this leads to him ordering the purge. Oh my gosh. Interesting.
Okay. Ooh.
Ilana is on the island for this, but leaves somewhere around this time. Footnote 2. Perhaps Jacob transports her off the island before the purge to keep her safe. Do we know that Ilana was ever on the island? Oh my gosh. This email is doing like wizard chess on my brain. All right. Shortly afterwards, Ilana is injured and Jacob visits her off island. He tells her that he will need her help one day, heals her injuries, and gives her Richard-style non-aging powers. Okay, so he thinks Ilana is immortal, which I did not. Oh, right, because Jacob's trapped, so how could he get off island? So Ilana has to be immortal for this timeline to work, basically, I think. After this, the cabin goes unused. At some point between the purge and this episode, the Circle of Ash is broken. I suggest that it's already broken in Man Behind the Curtain, but that we don't see the break there. Perhaps Nikki and Paolo discovered the cabin and broke the circle in a scene we didn't see. This allows the Man in Black to use it for his long con against Locke. Finally, Ilana returns to the island and checks on the cabin, looking for Jacob. Instead, she finds that the Man in Black has been using it and a message from Jacob to direct her to the statue. So for Ilana, I feel like Jacob's visit is usually dated to the 2005 through 2007 Oceanic 6 period. But for the purpose of this theory, I need to push it back in time since I'm linking it all to the Purge. Consequently, I need to find a reason for Ilana to look the same age in the off-island and present-day on-island material. Number 4, footnote, in the context of Man Behind the Curtain, Ben knows that Jacob used the cabin at some point in the past, but doesn't expect to find him or anyone else there right now. I mean, my main issue with this, with all of this, is when you look at the freeze frame, like, screen grab of who's in the chair, it doesn't look anything like Mark Pellegrino, which is fine because, like, they hadn't cast him yet for Jacob and stuff like that, but it's like...
Yeah, isn't it one of the... It's actually, like, some member of the crew.
Oh, it might be. I mean, like, whoever they are, they have, like, founding father hair and, like, pirate clothes, kind of. I know we had already seen the foot of the statue, but I feel like they made Jacob look like he could have been on the Black Rock. Like, that's about as far back as they were willing to go. Not that Mark Pellegrino with his, like, gingerness looks like an ancient Egyptian or anything like that, but, like... I don't know. It's just like, it's so aggravating and messy, the cabin stuff. So this is I usually don't get mad at Lost for inconsistency stuff, but it's like, I just want to figure it out. And the answer is you can't figure it out because it doesn't actually make sense.
I like this idea that at some point Jacob used the cabin to meet with Richard, because like the weirdest thing about Jacob's cabin is it's like attributed to Jacob, like, both by Ben here and by Ilana later when she gets to the island, when they could have just said it was somebody pretending to be Jacob, like, from the get-go. Like, it could have been, like, this weird monster force. And, like I tried to hint at, like, in the calm, at some point you could reverse everything that's said about Jacob in this episode with stuff we actually learn later about Jacob. So I don't think we actually learn anything about Jacob.
But I just don't, like, I don't understand that, like, I just don't understand who Jacob talks to. Does he talk to Richard? If he talks to Richard, why does he need a Ben or a Charles or an Eloise?
Again, why isn't Richard in charge?
Yeah.
Well, and if he talks to Richard, how come Richard doesn't know what Ben's doing?
Yeah.
And why is Richard surprised when John's going to go see... Jake.
Maybe we're so soupy. Maybe we're in a preacher, mythology where it's like at some point before the purge, like, Jacob stops talking to Richard, and for all Richard knows, like, God is dead. And then Ben comes up, and he's like, I can talk to Jacob. And Richard's like, oh, why have you forsaken me? And then at least it leads to the way that the others sort of are like, Locke shows up and he's like, I'm going to talk to Jacob. And they're like, oh, now he's the leader. Like, just sort of that assumption makes it feel like that could, like, Jacob suddenly deciding not to talk to Richard anymore could be traumatic to Richard. Because I don't think we see them actually talk to each other.
We do when we, in Abiturno.
Well, in the flashback, I mean. In flashback. Because, like, by the time, you know.
Well, there is, like Richard is feeling forsaken by Jacob in the final season.
Yes.
But, like, we're not seeing any of that, like, is God dead sort of questioning from him here.
Well, because apparently Ben's been talking to him.
But, like, why wouldn't Richard, an immortal being who knows Jacob very well, be able to more quickly sniff out the lie that, like, and it is the source of Richard being like, okay, let's listen to Ben, the fact that Ben sees his dead mom, and why does Ben see his dead mom?
Well, what if it's like, so...
why?
I mean, we're headcanning it, but this is also where the email came from, so I feel like we are allowed to be in that thing. But if it's like, Jacob stops talking to Richard, and then this little boy sees something that, as far as Richard knows, isn't possible. So then it's like, you're mystified by this little boy who then says he spoke to God. I mean, isn't that, you know,
I guess I need to, like, stop having such high regard for Richard, because the truth is, like, Richard also got fooled by, like, a timey-wimey John Locke, self-fulfilling prophecy of...
I like Richard a lot, and he's a cool character, but I don't think he's a smart character. He's just there. Just be, like, even in the past, people just show up and are like, hey, Richard, here's the new status quo. And we like him because they're right. But in reality, Richard's, like, leading some others, and Daniel Faraday shows up and is like, here's how things are going to be. Like, I don't...
Okay, so maybe I should just start thinking of Richard as, like, our island himbo. And, like, less like our wise island
he's
immortal.
He's the himbo man of faith.
Well, like,
he has so much faith in whoever Jacob decides is supposed to be the leader, I guess. He's just going to follow that guy until
like,
a new guy.
That's the thing is, like, I'm like, if Jacob is not actually picking Ben or John, then, like, Richard is a dummy for picking them, right?
Yeah, or believing that the island is... So my interpretation of the scene between young Ben and Richard is that as young Ben is describing what he saw, Richard is, like, seeing the chosen one.
Right.
In a way, you know, it's like the whole, like, what Trinity sees in the Matrix before Neo figures it out.
What Qui-Gon sees in Anakin.
So
Of midichlorians.
It is the show sort of imbuing Richard with this talent to identify who is special, which helps when he's talking to John Locke. But yeah, I don't know if it works so well over the long run, because isn't Richard just special?
Well, I mean, we also skipped over the part where he's like, oh, is this kid special? And then Saeed shoots him in the gut and Richard has to put him in the magic mud water. So by the end of this, Richard knows Ben is at least resurrectable. Ugh.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I'm sorry for going down.
Now you brought up the temple, and I'm really mad.
I was fine for like 10 minutes of this, but then I hit the lost wall.
I love this show, but
stuff.
Should we talk about the Annie thread?
Well, we should, because I think we basically forgot to mention her in the calm. So too bad, because we'll only get a slight little nod to her later on.
Well, yeah, so she's not dead, because we find out in season 5 that, like, Daniel Faraday told the Dharma Initiative to evacuate all their children, so the children are gone for the purge. So, like, Daniel at least, like, I don't know how that fits into whatever happened, but we'll get there when we get there. But basically, like, Annie's not there, and Michael Emerson has said, and other people have said on the show, that it was their initial intention to bring her back as an adult, as, like, a love interest prospect for Ben, and, like, a poignant sort of something. You know, Annie was going to come back, and then they just, you know.
Ran out of time.
They ran out of time. But And I also have to imagine that Samantha Mathis was going to come back, but because we get a lot more of creepy Doug Hutchinson. But I don't know what happened there, but he has a different wife in season 5.
Why don't we keep it with Annie and lay some volcano knowledge on me? Does that ever come up again?
Sure doesn't, but they were planning to. Yeah, the volcano was supposed to be like the big, a big part of the finale, and this was going to be like the first seed that they planted of it, and then they just didn't do it, and that's okay. I think I'd prefer it because I was...
probably for the polygons on that one would have been
yeah.
I would the end fight have been on the volcano or would the light have been in the volcano?
Oh.
Ooh. Or like Jack and Locke fighting Jack and fake.
Or
Locke
they have
fighting.
To they have to like plug replug the volcano.
Or it would be funny if like the mother's like, you need to protect this light, and they're like, from who? Who is going to go inside of an active volcano? Like, it's...
And Jack Shepard's like, hold my beer.
Yeah, he's like, my dad might be down there.
So what?
I heard some ice.
What do you think they changed it? Because, see, at the end of season 3, if we refresh my memory, is that when the island moves for the first time?
Yes.
No, season 4.
Oh, season 4. Yeah, sorry. Because we have to get the people off the freighter. And when they go back to the cabin in season 4, the person in the cabin tells Locke to move the island, which is why I like the idea at the beginning of Matt's email that the cabin is capable of moving around the island, like the island's capable of moving around the
Well, although, like, there's all these special locations that feel like, you know, like the golden light feels like it's capable of moving, and the, you know, like there's the temple feel, you know, and like cloaking sort of stuff. Otherwise, like, everyone would have found all these places a long time ago. I mean, like, Nikki and Paula definitely did find all these places a long time ago, but, you know. Well, yeah, the ash is broken, and then it's definitely the Man in Black when they go back. It's Christian Shepherd as the Man in Black when they go back further.
But this, and we know that for sure because the creators answered that question. The Christian Black, Man in Black, Christian Black, works well. But yeah, this one, yeah, the ash is all confusing. And it seems like they kind of remember it for one instance in the final season, I think, when the Smoke Monster is attacking one of the Lana's men. He, like, drops a circle of ash, and that's the only time we see it work. Which, fine, but, again, just makes this whole cabin thing. I'm going to say Matthew is right, pending whatever we learn about Ilana moving forward in this rewatch. I'm okay the way that I've... This podcast storm section has made me okay thinking that Eloise Hawking has Jacob powers, of bestowing some more Jacob powers on some side characters to make this series make sense. That's my equivalent of trying to make ghosts make sense.
Here's the answer about the volcano, from our pal Emmy award winning, producer, Jeff Jensen. Jeff wrote on Entertainment Weekly, the volcano stayed in the back pocket until the producers started developing Lost concluding seasons. The premise that developed over time was that the volcano was a mysterious place that forged the ticking, shape-shifting monster, the billowing black mass known as Smokey. By season 6, the writers had settled on the concept that the island was like a cork that bottled up all sorts of bad stuff, some volatile stew of spiritual dark matter stuff that would rob life of meaning and goodness if unleashed. The question was always, how do you basically visualize and dramatize that idea that the island itself is all that separates the world from hellfire and damnation, says Lost co-creator and Emmy winner Damon Lindelof. And the answer was the volcano.
So the volcano was their first shot at the cork in the bottle of wine.
Well, yeah, and both. Metaphor. Though. But, like, Lindelof and Cuse initially envisioned a finale in which Jack and Smokey Incarnate would brawl over the fate of the island at Lost proverbial Mount Doom. The volcano had been dormant for the duration of the series, explained Lindelof, but based on moving into this endgame, the island had become unstable, and the volcano was going to erupt. We were going to have a lot of seismic activity, and ultimately there was going to be this big fight between the forces of good and the forces of evil, which end up in the series manifesting as Jack and the Man in Black in the midst of magma. Magma spewing everywhere! But Lindelof laughs at the crazy sounding scale of this notion now. Back in the day, Lost producers were full of why not chutzpah.
Then we actually ended the show, and all of us were brought down to earth.
I
don't mind that. I do think the wine cork metaphor, like watching that for the first time, and then when the man in black like breaks it on the log, I was like, ah, writers, television writers, succinctly described metaphysics that I'm not meant to understand. But maybe a volcano holding back like literal hell might have been the on the nose thing that could have worked. I don't think the polygons would have worked. Neil is correct in saying it's too early to try that.
And apparently, so like in Across the Sea, the mother, who's played by Allison Janney, was going to drag the man in black's dead body and like throw it into the volcano. And that's how the smoke monster is going to be created. And then Lindelof told Jeff Jensen, this is a quote from Lindelof, ABC was like, guys, we love you and we're letting you end the show, and we can't let you bankrupt the network in the process, because they had too many pricey things in the final season, including that damn temple.
So we got the temple, but no, the lights volcano in a river cave.
Yeah.
All right, tangent about the cabin for a second. There is this, I guess sort of famous at this point, map that a real-life cartographer named Jonah M. Adkins made of the Lost Island that I use for reference a lot because the geography is confusing. And I found this to be very fascinating. At the time he created it, the Adkins emailed to Entertainment Weekly to sort of explain how it was made. And this note in particular I found fascinating. He says, I didn't place Jacob's cabin simply because most of the time it was shown, it was in a different place. So there is sort of further evidence that the cabin was unable to be put on a map. The map that shows, and this has like the temple and, you know, all the different locations of everything that we've seen. But yeah, the cabin. It was
I think I've seen this. I'm Googling this map real quick because I think I remember seeing it and being like, oh, so what's on the north of the island? Isn't there like a... Oh, wait, no.
Yeah,
I was looking at a...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there we go. Yeah, there's like a little dearth of stuff at the north of the island.
What we're basically getting the start of is like the end seasons of Game of Thrones, and we're like, how'd they get there so fast?
Yeah, exactly.
I assume... a whole episode of Trek out to the Black Rock. We just run out there now? Okay, I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great map if you want to look it up. If you just search Lost Island map, it's usually the first
and
one.
Adkins
up,
is the best one. A-D-K-I-N-S. Don't look up Adkins, you'll get
the diet.
a map to weight loss.
But it's always been... It's always been so fascinating to me how close the temple is to, like, the barracks. So, like, the Dharmaville and the temple are supposed to be these things in sort of the north end of the island. So the cabin that they go to has to be not far from there, right?
Oh, that's it. It's the west side of the island that apparently has, like, nothing except the Ajira runway. Yeah. This map has, like, for when we start doing Lost 2, when we, you know, get around to it. We have this whole west side of the island.
Oh, never mind. Okay. West side? I thought it was the east side that's looking really spare. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
No, you're right. East side,
well,
sorry.
Well, then that's true of Oahu.
I know cardinal directions.
So, the leeward side of Oahu is actually pretty, like, all the stuff's on the, like, the north shore and the west coast of Oahu. So, I don't know how...
Oh, yeah, but here the heart of the island is basically next to the cockpit. That's interesting.
And he put like the crash site and all that stuff like basically down where like Waikiki and Honolulu are and stuff like that. So this feels very Oahu inspired, which is not a bad inspiration for a lost map. So yeah, cool,
excellent. Yeah, I think we did it. I think we stormed. I am excited to be in the awesome part of season 3. I saw some call me's really feeling the pull of the spoilers, and I'm excited to watch them like slowly turn against Jack and then watch him act like an ass for a whole episode and then realize he's in the future. So it's all coming up. But first, Neil, where are we going next week?
Well, next week we've got to play some of the greatest hits with Charlie.
Charlie!
And since we're in the storm, I think everybody knows what's about to happen. And greatest hits hits very nicely.
It's really good.
In that context. It's a really good episode.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know what's coming in the finale.
It's good.
You know?
So until next week where we start our greatest hits, where can people find more of your work online? Let's start this week with Neil Miller.
Well, you can get me here on this podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at Rejax, at One Perfect Shot. And yeah, that's pretty much it for the moment.
And Joanna Robinson.
Oh, hi. You can find me on VanityFair.com or you follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can listen to my other two podcasts, Little Gold Men and Still Watching. That's it, right? Yeah, that's it.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, on the podcast Joanna Forgot, Republic City Dispatch, which covers The Legend of Korra, and on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where I talk about pop culture, but will not find me writing online currently because the world is busy for everybody and bad and sad, and I encourage you guys to, you know, take in news only as you need it, but also try to keep making the world a better place. Yeah, come hang out with us. But, you know, put out positivity. If you could put out some positivity, maybe you could make like a spore buffer of positivity around yourself. It keeps out the corona, spongy. I hear. I'm not a doctor.
No, it doesn't.
not a doctor. But what I will tell you, and what is important to your safety, and I think a lot of doctors would back me up on, is please don't fall down. It's very important that you only lose your footing when you intend to, like jumping or sitting down or kneeling, you know, traditional things. Don't fall down. We'll see you next week talking about Lost.